But like, it's crazy how many people get like seriously hurt, and you really can't like, you can't let it get you. Not that many guys go visit people in the hospital when they're hurt. Like when you're racing, I mean, I had one teammate. I mean, I'm in this neck brace now, but I had a teammate that broke his C1, C2. Like should have been paralyzed. You know, he was in a halo, drilled into his skull, shoulder supports, the whole thing. And like, I remember going to the hospital, and I was the only guy on my team that did to go visit him afterwards. And it was kind of like, it was terrifying.
All Aspects is brought to you by Aspect Abbey. Aspect Abbey is a new safety tool that helps you make safer decisions in the backcountry. Did you know that we currently, as an industry, spend $1 billion per year on reactive avalanche gear? So that's your beacon, shovel probe, airbag. All those things only help you after you've been avalanche. Aspect Abbey is the first preventative avalanche safety tool that is designed to keep you out of avalanches altogether. Our algorithm processes a huge amount of data and scrapes the avalanche forecast in every forecast zone across the country. Then it shows you on the map where it's high and low risk for today's avalanche danger. Clear means low risk. Red is high risk. Red equals dead. Don't go in there. This is called adaptive slope shading, or ASS. The reason why this is so revolutionary is because it changes and updates as the conditions change. Nobody else has ASS because we invented it. Aspect Abbey also has a ton of awesome tools built into it, like a tri-axis slope angle meter, trailhead and drop-in checklist, and my personal favorite, the forecast update tool. The best part is Aspect Abbey is giving away this life-saving tool 100% free. Aspect Abbey is committed to making the backcountry safer and more fun for everyone in our community. You can download Aspect Abbey on iOS right now for the App Store. Android, it's coming soon. Remember, there are dozens of apps that get you into the backcountry, but only Aspect Abbey is designed to bring you home safely. Thanks to our business daddy, Aspect Abbey, for making the All Aspects podcast possible. Now let's get to the show. Okay, what's up, guys? Good morning. We have Will Frischkorn here with us on the pod today. Will is a ex-pro cyclist. He's our first Tour de France rider, which to me, I mean, for a podcast of this like magnitude, I'm surprised we haven't had a Tour de France guy yet, to be fair.
Right? I mean, come on.
And you are also a entrepreneur. You and your wife live here in Crested Butte. You do a fair amount of backcountry skiing. You're teaching your kids about backcountry skiing. I think you guys have a really cool story, and we're really excited to have you guys on. Well, you on. Coral's not here. And then for people who are not watching this, Will, you're in a neck brace right now. Do you want to run us through that real quick?
You know, short, long, I highly recommend, if you were ever thinking about a 12-foot reverse swan dive, have water underneath you for the landing zone, not a hardwood floor and a foosball table. Yeah, it was... They say ladders are dangerous, and ladders are dangerous, kids. If you're thinking of carrying like an 80-pound mattress up a ladder with one hand hopping rung to rung, just don't do it. Just say no. Get some help. But yeah, I bounced off this thing 2 weeks ago, landed on my back 12 feet down, cracked the C6, C7, T1, T2, T3 vertebrae all. So I got a pretty good ding, but unbelievably lucky. You know, I can still email and drive, where, you know, there's a good chance otherwise I would not have been able to do so. And you know, the outcomes could have been burly. So that's risk you should not take. Ladders, one hand. But no, I feel awfully lucky to be on here today, man.
Well, damn, dude. I'm glad you're okay. That's super scary. Yeah. Well, let's just jump right in here, man. Can I just like ask you right off the bat? Because I've always been curious about this. You know, you watch like the Unchained or the Tour de France show on Netflix or whatever. There's all the guys in the Peloton. And they're like within, you know, centimeters of each other. Are you guys all talking shit to each other? Or are you just like kind of chatting about your day? What's going on in there?
There's a lot of chatting about your day. There's a lot of like, you're either suffering so hard, there's no conversation, or you're actually kind of on chill mode where like the brakes up the road, everything's stable, you know, and you're having good conversation. Yeah, it might not be like super fluid. There might be some pauses. You might be breathing a little harder than normal, but no, cycling is a wonderfully social sport. Actually, it's kind of fun in that way. Even, you know, there are days when you're racing, you know, full gas, 6 hours, you know, there's not a word said other than get the fuck out of the way. You know, we're going, you know, yakking in your radio to your team. But there are other days where it's lovely and you go, I mean, it's essentially like going for a big long ride with a bunch of buddies, until the end. And then it's game on.
Just a casual 200-kilometer bike ride. with the boys.
I mean, you
need
to be in the draft. I mean, you're just sucking a wheel all day long. It's easy. No, it's kind of funny. Actually, now I constantly, you know, after I retired, it's been 15 years or so now. You know, I did not ride a bunch for a couple of years. Started business, had kids. I mean, there was probably 4 or 5 years where I rode 4 or 5 times. But I got super into trail running. And that was definitely like how I burned a lot of that pent up energy that needs to get out every morning. And you get back on a bike, and even when you're like relatively fit doing something else, you know, I'd go out and I'd ride and be like, I have no idea how I used to be able to do that. Like, I could actually go fast. That was good. And I'm not anymore. Now it's like, you know, old ladies and kids are blasting by me. But it's a lot more fun now.
I've been out with you. I don't believe that at all. So, Will, I got to ask you a little bit about your Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde nature, because I think anyone who knows you is like, wow, Will is a remarkably positive, upbeat person, just puts out great energy into the world. But then there's this like alter ego, the shadow side that we all have. And I got a little glimpse of that when we were out for a ski and you were like, oh yeah, that's so wild. Yeah, I put that guy in a ditch it wasn't even a race. It was just like a local race. Was it a local race?
It was a local race, and he was doing something that didn't mesh with the etiquette of what should have been happening. And
the unwritten rules, he was violating the unwritten rules, and you took on the enforcer role. And I was asking your
wife, there was a ditch available.
I turned to her and I was like, he could have like wrecked this guy, like broken collarbone or worse. And she's like, oh yeah, Will's totally psycho when you get him on a bike. It's just like what the guy you know now doesn't exist. So how do you hold those two things? Like, upstanding citizen, loving father and husband, and then enforcer when you're on the bike.
You know, it's kind of like a persistent slab avalanche, right? Most of the time, you don't want to do anything mean. You're just kind of hiding out deep down there. You're being nice. You're letting people ski the pal. But then every once in a while, you got to get it done. And whatever it is, you just got to do it. And if it messes someone up, it messes someone up. But you know, hopefully it doesn't too badly.
Did you just like run him off the road, or you know, were you like what's etiquette? Are you allowed to give him a little bump?
You just kind of like make room go away. And if someone's coming and they're shooting for room and that room is gone, you know, their options are kind of limited. Typically they choose the option of not running into someone from behind and, you know, thinking they might be able to ride it out in the grass. But in this case, opportune ditch was there and served its purpose.
That checks out.
Wow.
Well,
different world.
Well, I mean, kind of on that note of running into ditches on a bike, you know, like, the races that you did are these, you know, these tours of whole countries, right? So you guys are doing, you know, 2 to 3 weeks riding every day, right? I mean, like how do you guys kind of go through that, managing your risk? I mean, there's so much risk there. There's physical risk of crashing, fatigue, like that kind of stuff. Also like health risk of just like dehydration and like, are you eating enough? Like, how are you getting enough calories going for like what you're burning? Like, can you kind of just walk us through what's like generally talked about, you know, like when you guys are on the bus or like in your pre-race meeting or that kind of stuff?
You know, I think big picture, there is so much risk in a lot of sports. And when you start out, when you're young, you're getting going, you kind of just have to pretend it's not there. You know, I think there's a huge element speaking specifically to cyclists, but I have to assume it's similar in other sports where, you know, it's your dream as a kid. So you're young, you bounce off stuff, you get hurt, you get better quick. You know, as a kid, you don't necessarily have a great ability to judge risk or make critical choices. You go with it, especially when it's something like, you know, for me, when I was like 16, I started racing bikes, had pretty good success pretty quickly. And it was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And almost anything that's in the way of that, you have to tune out. Whether it's, you know, honestly, it's becoming like quite selfish. You know, a handful of years later, I look back and was like, wow, I was, you know, still a very nice person. I tried to be, but I was pretty selfish like every athlete for those years, because you have to pour everything into it. And then anything that is in your way that often has a risk element to it, you just play ostrich, you know, put your head in the sand and pretend it's not there. And honestly, through my career, through the 10 plus years that I was racing professionally, I think one of the most telling things is when someone gets hurt, like seriously hurt, you know, in the middle of a race, like you see it happen and you barely pause. Like you watch a friend, you know, go flying off the side of the road and smash into a tree, and you're like, they're definitely going in an ambulance. You pause for like 2 seconds and then you're back on it and you're going. You know, I think in the time that I was racing, there were 3 or 4 races that were stopped. And that's one of those things where you're like, whoa. But like, it's crazy how many people get like seriously hurt and you really can't, like, you can't let it get you. Not that many guys go visit people in the hospital when they're hurt. Like when you're racing, I mean, I had one teammate, I mean, I'm in this neck brace now, but I had a teammate that broke his C1, C2. Like should have been paralyzed. You know, he was in a halo drilled into his skull, shoulder supports, the whole thing. And like, I remember going to the hospital and I was the only guy on my team that did to go visit him afterwards. And it was kind of like, it was terrifying because it's accepting that like, oh yeah, this is what could happen. And then as you get older, you start understanding like, okay, this is part of it. And how do you try not to be an idiot and be like, oh, I can attack on the descent. It's like, no, I can go fast on the descent, but like, maybe that's not the spot to like try to stretch out a couple seconds. And that's, you know, I had a moment, oh God, it was springtime. We're racing in Belgium. It's nasty. I mean, you talk about getting sick. There's like cow shit flying up in your face. You're drinking it all day long because it's just raining and it's so gross. And you're constantly getting sick. I mean, it's like that element is, it's uncontrollable, you know, but in the span of like 3 weeks, I think I broke 3 bikes in these races. And there was one in Tour Flanders that year. I broke 2 bikes in the race. You know, these just like unbelievably huge catastrophic pileups that like you could do nothing about. Like you might be trying to control your risk, but like when 50 people crash in front of you and you're going 35 miles an hour and it's wet, like you just crash. You go into it, center punch it and just go like, oh, fingers crossed in the air. And I actually had a pretty solid issue for a while after that, like seeing our sports psych, he worked with our team, and I was kind of in the like, is this worth it anymore? Like this is dumb. And interestingly, it was a couple of years before I ended up stopping racing. And I think I was 26, 27 that spring. The year I was 28, I did the Tour de France. 29, I was on the team and then got sick right before it. And when I got super sick, you know, I was a reserve for the team, didn't do it. And, you know, we were just chilling out in Spain in that chunk of July, and kind of had the like realization of, huh, this was a really cool chapter. But for a whole number of reasons, ready to start the next one. And one element of that was definitely like getting hurt. Like I managed to skate through my racing career, never in one of these neck braces that, you know, putting away the laundry did to me the other day. And that was pretty cool. You know, I broke little bones, ribs, arms, you know, stuff that heals quick. But I had teammates that got, you know, just like wicked beat down. And I realized, huh, that didn't happen. And I still love riding my bike. What if I do something else? And I can still go out and love riding my bike, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I feel that like well, it's funny you said like when you're 26, I feel like 25 is when you realize you're mortal. Like that's like the age.
It's all terrible.
Yeah, man. And what you're saying, like, when I was 25, I had kind of the realization of like, dude, I really want to be able to ski for the rest of my life.
And yeah.
Because like, this thing that I love. And I was starting to kind of feel like I was pushing it on the edge of like, I don't know if the tricks we're doing, if, you know, like if I'm going to be built for that, you know, like going forward. And so I totally resonate with what you're saying there. Yeah. And then
I need to jump in and provide some context for the audience here. So people don't know this about either of you, but Dave competed in the X Games for many years and park and pipe and do it.
Never competed in the X Games, but thanks.
Oh, really? Oh, oops, my bad. All right. Pro skier and like, you know, 100-foot gap jumps, stuff like that. And like, you know, facing your mortality on a very regular basis. And Will, like, you are so close. Like you know, you'll never cough this up, but with a little sleuthing, I found out that, you know, you missed winning a stage in the Tour by a wheel. It came in second. And so like, that's like the pinnacle of anyone's career. How did you navigate that transition and say, you know what, that chapter is over. Here's what I'm going to do for this next chapter.
It was a big, big decision. And honestly, like, I feel like my cycling career was bookended by two really hard, but wholeheartedly like enthusiastic grab them, go with them decisions, but that both were kind of risky. I mean, the first was when I was 16 years old. I was on a very academic track. I was at prep school up in New England. You know, it's like channel to the Ivies. Everyone's very boring, and they're in New York now, making a bunch of money, you know, investment banking and stuff. And I was like, huh, this bike racing thing's really cool. And we had a cycling team there, schoolboys racing, and my coach was awesome, like super super cool, inspiring, you know, mentor figure. He had raced professionally, lived in the town adjacent to where the school was, and he would take us out on rides, and ex-pros would come and ride with us. And I was like, huh, like amazing. And he really encouraged me to chase cycling. But that quickly led to the point where it was like, I was not going to be able to stay on this academic track. I was not going to be able to stay at the school. I got invited to move to the training center, the Olympic Training Center down in Colorado Springs. My mom actually took the letter, the invitation letter, and redlined the 37 grammatical and spelling errors in this one page invitation letter. She was like, honey, I don't know if this is a good idea. I was like, oh, come on. This is awesome. Yeah, they're not supposed to be smart. Come on, mom. Like we're burning brain cells all day long out there. But it was a huge thing. It was like, okay, I'm stepping out of a very traditional path, with a very traditional, you know, likely outcome to like hopefully this friggin' works. And Dave, you know, still, I mean, it's like, it's really challenging for kids that are on that or at that level in sport where you have to make the decision of like, do I go all in and sacrifice almost everything else for it? Is that the right decision? And, you know, with a dream and with, you know, blinders on, you just go for it, you know. But it was a hugely risky thing. And then to forgo college, you know, I didn't go to college. I never got a higher education. I've been traveling around the world riding my bike pretty fast. And I am eternally grateful for that education. It was like the coolest one I could ever have. But that was that conversation with my parents. It was a big one. And I was like, yeah, I'm not. I've got a pro contract in my hand for next year. You know, I'm also applying to college at the same time. Are you guys okay with me making this choice? Like, not, you know, school will be there later, hopefully. And they're like, yeah, school will be there later. And looking back, I can't believe that they were as supportive as they were. I mean, it was so cool. I would struggle with that with my kids right now. I mean, my 10-year-old's right, like, right. I don't want to go to college because you didn't. And if I go to college, I got to leave mom. And I'm like, solid. Both, you know, I love mom too. She's cool. And, you know, I did not go to college and life worked out. But college is cool. So that was a huge decision. And, you know, looking back, so risky, you know, in terms of life trajectory. Totally. And I just got lucky it worked. You know, so many of my teammates as 18, 19 year olds, you know, within 2 years after that, were no longer racing. And that transition out of sport, when you've given it everything at that point in life and it's not your choice, is really hard. Like, yep. Really hard.
Yep. Dude, it's your whole identity. Like, you don't even know. It's like, you're like, it's almost like a part of you died. It's crazy. Yeah.
And I watched that happen to some of these guys. I mean, it was just like tragic. And then the number that fell off the wagon and like, in ways you would never want to. And it's fun now, like actually seeing some of them, like, you know, 20 years on, you're like reconnecting, like, oh, whoa, like you found it eventually, but it was hard for 5 years. And a lot of guys have that same thing at the conclusion of their career. So like when I stopped, I was 29. My wife and I, girlfriend at the time, we were living in Spain. Most of what I was doing was over in Europe. And we had that moment, like this just kind of realization of like, let's do the next thing. And I ended up having a super soft transition, which was great in that my team was like, hey, work for us on the marketing side, the management side. So I ended up for a year working for the team, kind of feeling out like, would this be an interesting direction? Our team director was a good friend of mine.
Still had that culture, the support network of the team that you're familiar with, community. Oh, interesting. Wow. That's
and
really
so comfortable. And, yeah. It was great. I mean, I essentially got a year to, one, make some unbelievable connections in the industry. I worked with all of our sponsors. I got to put together a hospitality program. So, you know, you give $1 million to the team from your company. You come hang out at the Tour de France, get to fly on a helicopter and watch stuff. I mean, super fun. But I also realized, okay, this is not where I want to go long term. And at the time, my wife and I, we were spinning on some business ideas. And we had fallen in love with like the small markets of Europe. Food, wine, community are like, it's our foundation. And there are all these like epic little markets over there. I mean, every street corner has one. And there's one in Girona, Spain, where we live, called the Rigo, that if you were in Girona, like riding your bike around, you see this little corner thing and you've been to our store in Boulder that we started, you know, a couple of years afterwards, you'd be like, that was it. And we just took this huge flyer. I mean, this was the next like big, you know, idiotic, like risky decision we took, was like, we're going to step out of like what's pretty comfortable and pretty awesome and we're going to try to start a retail food business as two young people that have never worked in retail food and never really done much other than like ride bikes. And my wife, you know, she was a graphic designer. We're like, we're going to go for it. And to like compound it, we ended up starting it in a building. We took on a lease with another couple. So we had two couples running businesses in a building.
Wow.
And my dad, who was a business consultant, was like, huh, you know, all the stuff that we've like done over the years, like I kind of thought you were a little smarter than that. Like, but go for it, kids. Have fun.
He's like, cool, man. First, it was not going to college and cycling. Now you're like, he's like, are you just going to choose the hard route in everything you do? Like what?
Yeah, it's like a potential 4% margin. Huh? That does not seem like a good business idea. I was like, but come on. And again, we got lucky. It was awesome. We started this business called Cured in Boulder. Specialty food, cheese was the heartbeat, you know, but it was charcuterie, wine, olive oil, like all the stuff we loved eating and drinking and having around the house. And we 10, 12 years in, we ended up getting super lucky. You know, it had developed into a pretty real little business at the time. We had a great team, you know, 30 folks working for us and catering and gifting and, you know, all the stuff around food. But COVID prompted sort of the next ripcord, which was, it was just too much. You know, we have kids, they're 8 and 10 now. And, you know, last year at Christmas, or 2 years ago, Christmas Eve, my wife's like, huh, this is the first Christmas Eve we've all been home as a family. Like, this is pretty cool. You know, this business was so all consuming that we knew we needed a change. And we found a great buyer for it, you know, great at the time. And, but it got us out, gave us the flexibility to just full on ripcord life where we sold our business, our cars, our house, everything, put like, you know, most of the stuff we got rid of, you know, 10 by 20 foot storage container, put what was left in there. And we took a year and traveled and did a full loop of the world with the kids, homeschooling them, and just like bucket list trips, things we could never have done, you know, previously with time. So it was pretty cool. And then we landed here in CB and trying to figure out what's next now. Yeah, it was travel was amazing.
Well, I gotta admit something to you, man. I'm totally embarrassed by this because we've like hung out, we've talked. I had no idea that you guys started Cured. Like
that was our baby, our first baby.
No one has ever said that to me. Like you never said, you guys were like, yeah, we started this like cheese shop, blah, blah. Like I was just like looking it up and I was like, oh my God, dude, I've been to Cured. This place is great. Like it's like a Euro kind of deli. Spot. Dude, I think I got, did you guys have like a brunch pizza or something there?
We had so much fun with food. I mean, it was pretty epic over the years.
I think I went to like a brunch there and I was like, dude, that place rocks. So anyway, that's embarrassing. Yeah, we miss it. So awesome.
Well, Will, you're more than welcome to reprise the Cured experience for your friends and neighbors here in Crested Butte. We're happy to come over and give you that opportunity to experience that fun all over again.
We will make it happen here at home. No, we still have a handful of personal belongings scattered around the world. And one of the coolest things that I need to go snag back at some point, we have when we sold the shop, we had a couple of these like beautiful Italian handmade mechanical prosciutto slicers.
Oh yeah.
And one is actually sitting at a friend's house in Boulder right now. And it's, you know, you put the leg on there and crank this thing. It's just this perfect paper thin prosciutto comes off. So it'll be living on the counter here soon. We'll let you know.
That's like some nice hardware too. Those things ain't cheap. That's like Ferrari.
It's pretty cool. Yeah.
One of my favorite things is going over to Will's house and he cranks up his fancy espresso machine. And I know it's going to be the best coffee of my week. And I'm just like, oh, I can't wait. Surprise me.
Makes it happen.
Yeah. Damn, dude. Well, you just went through like everything, just like knocked it all out.
Oh.
That was wild. But let me... Let me loop back to something else. You mentioned when you're talking about watching your buddies like crash and that kind of thing and how you had to deal with kind of like some mental stuff post either you crashing or like seeing your buddies crash. And like, I think anyone who's, and I'm Jeff, I'm sure you can relate to this too. Like anyone who's dealt with where like, you know, you're doing something dangerous, right? Like, and it's part of, I think, your programming as a human, right? Like you don't have bandwidth for that. So you just like turn it off. Like that's just not something you think about. And then it's almost more shocking than when one of your friends or colleagues or competitors like has a big blow up, because it's like all of a sudden you're faced with the reality of this, the, of the you know, the consequences.
Yeah, the potential consequences.
Yeah. Wow. And like, I wonder for you, you know, racing at that high of a level, do you think it was harder when you like which was harder? Like when you personally had a crash or like when you'd see things that were out of your control happen around you? Because I know
it was out of control for sure. Yeah. No, it was, okay. You know, if you make the mistake, it's like, yeah, you fucked up. You went off the road, you pushed it too hard. It was like, you know, theoretically there was an element of control that you had, and you made a bad judgment. Yeah, I think the thing that was hardest for me in cycling and would probably quickly most folks is just the complete lack of control. And it is, it's the joke earlier about persistent slab. It's like, it is that where like you're cruising along and you're going 30, 40, 50, 60 miles an hour down a hill. And like, if the dude ahead of you hits this little crack in the road and goes down, like there was no control. I mean, that's just shit luck.
Totally.
And that happens. And that's, you know, most of the really bad accidents. It's that, you know, one of these ones in Flanders where like, you know, 50 of us went down, you know, bike just destroyed, you know, these Belgian cement roads have these little gaps between the you know, where the compression gaps in the concrete, you know, over the years they spread. Yeah, you know, they fill with water because it's raining and nasty. You know, you drop a tire down into this thing, bike just stops, flips, goes.
Totally.
You know, and all of a sudden, you know, all these dudes are on the ground, and there was nothing they could do. And I think that's, without a doubt, the hardest part. Yeah. And coming to grips with that, and then at a certain point, as you said, you have that like moment where mortality comes in and self-preservation instinct comes up, and you go, huh, like is that worth it? And you try to do what you can to control it. And you try to work through it. And you try to like put your head back in the sand. And some guys are better at that than others. And also you figure out what you can do to control it. I mean, if you look at controlling uncontrollables, like you look at like Lance Armstrong, for example, who, interesting dude, amazing, like unbelievably successful, inspiring, all this stuff. But like he, I think the most impressive thing he did was manage to make it through his 7 tours without like a horrible crash. And they managed that by literally like putting their team on the front and just like, he would never be more than 10 dudes back. He'd always be right up there and, you know, you go into a finish and you get swamped, but like you have to have a number of things aligned to make that possible. You know, the further you are back in the group, the more people ahead of you could theoretically have an accident. You know, you control that in a way you can. Pretty impressive.
Dude, there's that crazy video where he, I don't know what year this was, but he goes off the road and just rides like just
yeah,
off
over the grassy
like,
field
yeah for like 100 meters on a freaking road bike and then just hop back on and like keeps
back on the other side
like,
and goes
yeah. Like he didn't even jump off, he just rides it like
no that was his one that could have been bad and worked out right where you're like damn
unreal.
that's crazy
dude. I can't ride a road on my dirt road like
gravel bikes. You gotta get one of those things, get rid of the road bikes now. We don't even have one anymore. No, we literally got rid of road bikes and just rolled gravel and mountain bikes, especially here in Crested Butte. Like, you know, mountain biking is so good.
Totally.
Well, it made me think of when we're talking about risk and randomness and what's within our control and what's out of our control, it made me think there's this really fascinating cognitive bias that's been super well documented. And that is when good things happen to me, I ascribe them to my brilliance, my hard work.
Of course.
Because I'm in control of my destiny.
It's preordained.
Bad thing happens to me. That was some serious bad luck.
Always.
And so much of it is, you know, Dave always laughs because I always say like, hey, we're going to put ourselves in a position to get lucky. We're going to work really hard and leverage our knowledge and experience and set ourselves up for success. But ultimately, there's going to be some luck and randomness involved. And, you know, particularly when we're dealing in the natural world, there's a lot of chaotic events and it's kind of a bell-shaped curve of random possible outcomes and we can influence it. But that feeling of control when we're in the backcountry and like, oh, we slayed this big line. We have our finger on the pulse. We knew exactly what was going on. You know, that's that cognitive bias kicking in where I'm like fluffing my own feathers, being like, oh, we're so clever. We're riding steep stuff on a considerable day with the PWL and we've outsmarted the problem. And it's like, well, we can do that for a while and eventually our luck runs out. And then, you know, if something bad happens to her, like, I don't know what happened. Oh my God. You know, we've been doing it like this for so long. I can't believe this just happened. That was some bad luck. And you're like, Yeah.
Biggest challenges with the Avalanche world, right? It's like you don't have negative feedback until it's real negative.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, it's catastrophic, like, negative often.
It's like hardest thing is you're just like, okay, with this one particular risk fact, like, I don't know, risk category. It's not like other things where you're like, okay, like you can have a little crash here and you learn from that. Or like you, like, oh, you blow a tire and you learn from that. Like, it's like everything's fine and then maybe potentially life ending. Hey everyone, hope you're enjoying the pod so far. I just wanted to take a quick break to tell you about one of the most unique features of AspectAdvy, which is the forecast update tool. The forecast update tool allows you to input real-time feedback about snow conditions and stability into the app as you're touring. So say we're out touring in this area, it's a moderate day, but all of a sudden we experience signs of instability. We come up to the corner and we click this little button right here, brings up the forecast update tool. Then we can go in and let's say we got whoops and we got shooting cracks. We click done, your map is going to be updated to considerable avi danger and will now have the updated high and low risk areas painted onto the map in that forecast zone. This works even offline, which is super badass. If you want to try out the forecast update tool for yourself, head on over to the App Store and download AspectAdvy for free on iOS. Okay, back to the show.
Yeah.
Great.
No, so we got two kids. We have an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old, and it's fun because living here, you know, snow is life. It's why we came here. We love playing and stuff. You know, honestly, like the whole time I was riding bikes, I couldn't ski. There's a dangerous activities clause in almost every, you know, professional athlete's contract. You know, it's essentially don't do anything fun. You will get in trouble and not get paid if you get hurt doing something that is fun. That was one of the reasons why I was like kind of excited when I stopped racing. I mean, the first thing I did was like, Coral, guess what we're getting for Christmas? We're getting some touring gear. And we were living, you know, 45 minutes from the foothills of the Pyrenees. So we were like instantly like, cool, let's go out and play. You know, and her parents, who were both, you know, big in the alpine mountaineering guiding world for a bunch of years way back in the day, you know, they were like, well, perfect. We know what we're getting you for Christmas. You have your level one course, which was awesome. I mean, it's looking back, it was the first course we took, and it was right when we were getting into it. And I feel so lucky for that. You know, but I was just like stoked to be able to get back on skis. I grew up skiing, you know, until I got really serious about bike racing. I was ski racing, you know, just fun, you know. Definitely not any good, but having fun up in New England, and was just so stoked to get back out and be able to play. And now we've got two kids, 8 and 10. We're here, you know, last winter we're, you know, Coral and I every day they're at school, we're sneaking and skiing. And they're like, hey, can we do this? Our 10-year-old especially, he's got like that suffer mindset. You know, our 8-year-old's kind of like, huh, I could also have hot chocolate and go ski the lifts, and like it's pretty fun. Yeah. 10-year-old's like, yeah, let's go out there, and I love working really hard. But thinking about how you communicate risk and like distill it in the backcountry to kids, which I think is a whole other deal. And honestly, last year was super cool. One of our 10-year-old good buddies, his mom was like, my kid's a little bit of an idiot. And he risk is like, he doesn't process it. She actually got this little group of kiddos a little one day, like avi course with a buddy of theirs who's a guy. And like, coolest thing ever. You know, it was five little kids went out and dug pits, found a backpack hiding out down there, and you know, learned how to do all the stuff, and it was fun. And that, like, Holden and I, our 10-year-old, we'd already been starting down that road, and he took a ton out of this day. But it is really challenging trying to be like, okay, dude, like you're 10, you're getting to where you can actually get out there physically. You know, how can you do this for your whole life? And it's how do you be calculated in your choices? And, you know, if you want to push it hard, we've got this killer ski area just down the road. But if you want to go out and ski some pow and get a good workout and have a good time in nature, like, this is the way to do it. But let's be really clear with our choices of, you know, this yes, this no. And actually, Jeff, it was fun last year. Like, you know, I showed him the app, and our kiddos, we keep pretty far away from technology. But he's like, okay, I get this. Like, you know, it's very intuitive. And that's awesome. And it is a great, you know, assistance in the teaching process of, you know, ideally setting up some little kids for success for a long time, you know, and not taking risks that are unjustified in an environment that can be terminal.
How did you and Coral, what was your journey like for getting backcountry savvy and learning about snow and avalanches? What was that process like?
Oh, great question. So like we, you know, instantly I stop racing, we get touring gear, we're getting out playing. and realized mountains are big, you know, and she grew up, her parents were both ice climbers, rock climbers, mountain guides. And both of them they both pulled people out of snow, that weren't breathing. And they were awesome in that, just like fundamental, like, hey guys, we love what you're doing. Like, it was our life. They live in Mexico now where it's just warm and sunny because they got cold a lot of times over the years. But they're like, take it seriously, learn about it, you know, and really think about what you're doing. And I think that was an incredible foundation, you know, the Abbey course they gave us for Christmas, the first year we were playing, that set us in, you know, essentially did what Abbey One does. It just scares you. It's like, okay, like, is this really serious?
Confuses you.
Yeah, we did a rescue. Oh yeah. And it's like, whoa, like 20 degree powder. Does that work? I mean, I think that's the goal, right? It makes you really think about what you do and like understand the ramifications are legit. And then after that, we ended up, you know, one, just studying a bunch and reading. I mean, there's so much great literature out there and the internet opens it up even further. We spent a bunch of time in the backcountry. I mean, every year we could, we were, you know, there were years where work prevented, you know, more than 20, 30, 40 days. But I mean, a couple of winters ago, we probably got 100 days of touring, which is, I mean, it's just awesome. It was killer. Right after we sold the business and you know, we would drop off our kids to school every day, you know, and those 5 days a week, we'd go ski and, you know, get 4 or 5 hours in. And then on the weekend, we'd take the kids. I mean, it was the best thing. It was so good. But a lot of time out there and a lot of time, the two of us as partners, trying to really check each other. You know, I think everyone, we all know that, you know, maybe the ladies make better choices than we do. And it's awesome to have that balance. And I think the other thing for us that was killer is that as a couple, you know, you drop your kids at school and you go ski, like you definitely want to pick up your kids at school. There's no question there. And I mean, that's like the worst case scenario is imagining that situation. So we ended up over the years as well doing a number of additional courses. You know, we did formal 1-2 rescue, the things that are there, but then also just hiring some guides when we were in cool places to take us out and like, yeah, let's ski. But like, will you also essentially do this as a new refresher, which I think was awesome. Cause in the field time, especially once you kind of have the background of, you know, the, you know, what you read, yeah, put it to work in the field and to be able to see that, and be able to see that in different places as well. It's like you ski in one place all the time, you get super comfy there. But like, you know, we were up in Jackson 1 year and had this like awesome experience, like epic tours, but like with a lot of stopping and going, why? Like, show us why we're making these decisions. And Jeff, last year at one point, you were like, hey, when you go do this, just constantly keep asking why. And it so resonated because it's like, yeah, you want to understand it. I don't want to just go do it. I want to know that I can go do it myself as well. And maybe I won't push it quite as far because I like building that little more buffer, but I understand it, which is huge.
Yeah. Do you guys have a sense of how you managed risk in the past to now has evolved?
I think self-preservation instinct as you age continues to rise. You still want to go get your yayas out. Every once in a while you realize that that's pushing you a little harder than you should. But I mean, technology now, and I mean, obviously the app is a huge thing. But over the years, you know, we just really, you plan a little bit better before you go out. You make some like just clear yes, no's and kind of like people talk about like guides, you know, setting a run list for the day. It's just like, no matter what, we're not going to go over there. Like that's just a no-go zone. You know, we were skiing on Berthet a bunch and we were in the Front Range and the Current Creek zone was like a favorite. And you're like, Russell would be really fun today. You know, there's this awesome line off. It'd be super fun, but like, that's a no. And you watch a couple of, you know, idiots going up there and skiing on certain days and you're like, wow, that was fun for them. That's terrifying. You know, I just triggered a little thing remote over here and that was on like a rollover. They got lucky. But yeah, being more critical about setting boundaries, I think is one of the things that's changed the most for us. And then also just going out on certain days and not having any ambition to do, you know, to do something big, but just go, yeah, let's just go get a bunch of vert and a bunch of powder. And it's really fun. Yeah. You know, there's a zone, Jeff, you took us last year that, you know, Coney's, which is not far from town here. You can access it on skis. You don't need sled. You get in there and, you know, there are areas in it where there's potential risk, but there's one little zone that's pretty darn safe. And like, I mean, I bet we did 20 days in that zone last year because there were some sketchy days here.
Yeah.
And you're like, as long as we
so long, yeah.
a lot. But you're like, we've skied this, you know, 3 days a week. You know, you get a really good feel for it, and you're like, we'll just stick there because that works, and it's still a blast. And understanding that, where like it's not objective driven, it's not mission based. It's like, let's just go have fun, get tired, come home, and be happy.
Hey, Will, I want to correct you on one thing. The first time we went skiing, I didn't take you guys. You guys took me.
you set us up for success. No, so the first time we skied with Jeff,
would you see Jeff put you in a position to get lucky?
He put us in a position to get lucky. That was the goal. No, it was awesome. We met at Seesaw last year, you know, whatever, just over a year ago. And we came back home, and a couple days later, he's like, dude, there's this early season storm that hit. You want to go ski? Let's go test the app. You know, just been learning about it. And we did some, and we both downloaded, we got on the phones, we get the trailhead, you know, you're pretty quickly out of cell, you're offline mode. And we start out in this area, and he's like, okay, you guys take the reins.
Did that freak you out? Cause you probably thought, oh, we're going with a IFMGA guide. We're going to get guided. This will be great. And then it's like, no. You guys are going to guide me with the app. Good luck.
Well, the cool thing, I mean, I think you look at it and you're like, this is the zone where we're going to go play. Show us, you know, show me where to go safely. And the app made it very just intuitive, right? And you look at it, you're like, cool. This is go. This is no go. That go zone looks really fun. Sweet. Let's go play over there. And even as you're like on the slope, certain areas where like, you're like, okay, do we need to throw a kick turn in here? Like, head back the other direction. Are we starting to get there? And it's, you're like, oh yeah, cool. There's red. Boom. It was really, it was inspiring in that way. And I mean, you know, but we got home, you know, Coral and I afterwards, we've been contemplating investing in the company and helping it, helping the mission be realized. And we got home the next day. I was like, yeah, we got to be a part of this. This is, it's too good not to make happen. Mm. People need it. We were sold pretty quick.
It's cool hearing kind of the, you know, I've heard your guys' investor story for Aspitavi several times, but, you know, kind of having this conversation leading into it with a little more insight into how much you are playing in the backcountry with your kids and like how much, like it really does help put that whole picture together. Like, man, you know, when you were just talking a second ago, I was like, man, it must be a really hard thing because you don't want to discourage kids from being super stoked. Right, like they have that just overdrive,
makes the world go round.
Happiness, yeah, like, and you want to inspire that, and like, and honestly, like, feed off of it, right? You're like, fuck yeah,
best thing ever.
How do you also then balance, like, hey, I want you to be stoked, and I want you to have that unlimited mindset, but like, what we're doing right now is deadly, you know? Yeah. And then like, so the fact that then this tool comes along that you guys see, like, it makes so much more sense. Of that mindset you guys were in, are like, well, okay, wow, this is maybe the next step or kind of the future of where we're headed with this whole thing.
I think if you look at it from a kid's perspective too, you show them Gaia, and I have like all the apps. I love just geeking out on all that stuff and show them the, you know, Gaia, Onyx, you know, Caltopo, and you're digging in and you're like, yeah, there's so much information available there, which is fantastic. It's part of route planning. It's part, you know, all of that. But you show that to a 10-year-old and they're kind of like,
whatever.
Yeah, I understand that, sure. But if you show them something that's just like, yay, nay, like, and this is why there's this magic number, they get that. And that's what's so cool about it. And that also is one of the things, I mean, it's like the Steve Jobs story of taking an iPhone to like Africa and give it to like a 3-year-old there that's never seen tech, and instantly they're like swiping and figure out how it works just intuitively. Like, that was his like aha moment where it's like, oh, this is going to be big. Good choice. You know, it's kind of the same thing. It's how do you take a bunch of information and distill it and make it easy to use? And that I think for us, and especially when you start looking at kids that are using it, like yeah, I can get my kid Gaia. He's not going to get anything out of that other than like, whoa, this looks really cool. Look at all these colors. And like this is beautiful. But you can give them something like Aspitavi, and they could go and drive it and make it work, which is just huge.
You think you're going to have your oldest son put the skin track in and have him lead you on a tour?
Dude, heck yeah. No, he's a little beast.
As you're recovering from the neck injury, might be like, all right, out in front. Here you go. Yep,
you're breaking trail, dude.
That's your training.
Yep.
Get back.
Slowly build up to where I can chase him down. No, they're already at that point where you're like, oh man, they're going to be fitter than we are and faster than we are at all this real soon. It's terrifying.
It's brutal.
So, Will, I think you come from a background of folks investing. I know your sister's in the startup world, and I think your family as well. How do you approach risk when you're looking at as an angel investor, as you're looking at opportunities? Because if there's no risk, there's very little.
It's not worth it.
Exactly. So you got to balance that. How do you approach that when you're investing in companies?
Well, there's this app out there that you just put all the company info into, and they tell you a yes or a no. And it's just, I mean, wouldn't that be cool? There's the idea. Cool. Apply this. No, you know, it's a tricky one because obviously, yeah, without risk, you know, are you going to outperform? No, you gotta take some risk. And I think for companies like this, you know, it's a lot of it hangs on the hat of the man behind it, the woman behind it, the people that are making it happen. You know, you can look at all the numbers that have been conjured up out of thin air, and you know, is this, you know, could this work? Is this going to be the biggest thing ever in the world? Yeah, it sure is on this piece of paper, but what's reality? So you try to make a judgment call. It's just like playing outside, right? You try to go, you know, here's all the information that I have. You know, you're checking, ideally you do your due diligence and you find, you know, people that have worked with them over the years. You look at potential competitors, even in a space like this where it's, you know, Aspect Abbey is kind of an outlier. Yeah, they're competitors. What's the moat, right? You do kind of all the classic risk analysis things and viability as a business. And then you just kind of go, huh, does this feel right? And hopefully the feel, you know, hopefully the feel is right. And every once in a while, it's not. You know, fortunately, it's not, and then the avalanche takes you out. It's just like, well, you lost that money. So you got to make that call of how much money you're comfortable putting at risk. You know, is it enough to be impactful for the company? But also, is it a number that if this one were to just disappear, you're going to be okay? And that's kind of our calculus for it. But it's especially for really early stage stuff, there's a lot of gut to it, which you don't want to apply that in the backcountry in quite the same way. But we don't have a great tool for this yet.
How did you, if we describe gut as our intuition, our subconscious processing, how did you develop that subconscious, that skill set, that autonomic processing, if you will? How did you develop that, especially transitioning from cycling? Were you angel investing while you were still cycling?
So I was super fortunate, and my father had been in the VC world for a long time. And you know, from early on, I mean, when I made the decision not to go to college, it was like, okay, how am I going to continue my personal education and growth in a way that after cycling, ideally, you know, there's something there where the brain hasn't completely atrophied and burned away over the years. So I was able to see and be a part of a number of decisions, you know, through that chapter, and watch the choices that he made and understood those choices and what he was doing, and be involved with some of those as well, which was great. And then see the ones that didn't work out. And I think that's a really important part of it, is that, you know, no one's successful 100% of the time. You know, ideally no one's successful 50% of the time. And if you look at it from an investor perspective, you know, if you're lucky 30% of the time, you're actually doing really well. And ideally those 30, you know, wipe away the pain from the other 70. So I got to see that over the years, be a part of that over the years, and have that sort of practical education, which was great. But I don't think anybody ever hones it. You know, you hone it when you're done.
Totally.
What do you got going on in the background there, Will?
Oh, apologies. My wife just running through here. She's trying to pick up all the pieces of my life that I can't help with right now. It's brutal.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah, this spring I actually broke both of my hands. So I've been trying to maximize my health insurance dollars this year. I've gone like 10 years without a claim, and this year is an opportunity to really crush Anthem and take all the money we paid them over the last decade back. But Coral has picked up a whole lot as I've been not quite at full capacity for a number of months now.
Dude, I feel like every time, there was like multiple times where I've run into you and you have like a new cast on or something, and I was just like, Will, like, what the heck?
Yeah,
man?
What? Oh yeah, no. Two hands at the same time is not to be advised. If you're gonna break hands, do them one, let that one heal, then do the next. Space it out a little bit.
All right, I want
to. And I actually did that right after Coral tore her ACL in February.
Yeah, you so guys
she,
were.
She was down with ACL, and I was out with two hands. We're like, oh, we're like a clown here.
I want to loop back to your family upbringing. So it sounds like, you know, you just kind of probably sponged up like most kids of like, hey, this is just kind of our family tradition, much like, you know, we have our holiday traditions at Thanksgiving or Halloween or the winter holidays. And so tell me what that was like to just like sponge up and have conversations with your dad or just like overhearing him on the phone for work. And how did you take an interest in that afterwards?
You know, I was super fortunate in that he thought like financial literacy and education was really important. And even as kids, like he would get us going, you know, super early to understand it. It is. And most people, it doesn't happen. Totally. Which is like, we grew up in a way where like money, it was very transparent. We had conversations around it as a family early on, you know, at like 10 years old, I was put, you know, as a kid, you're going, yeah, here's your allowance, a couple bucks doing this. But like, they actually put me on like a hardcore, I was 10, 11 years old, like fairly substantial allowance, but it's like, you're buying everything. You have to learn how to actually budget.
No,
like I wanted to snowboard at one point. I was having fun with that. And I didn't have enough saved up. And my parents were like, well, we're not going to buy you one. If you want to snowboard, you got to figure out how to do it. And like, he, looking back, I find it funny because he called up his buddy. He was president of the bank. He was like, hey, I'm going to bring my kid in and you're going to like sit down with him, teach him about a loan. But you know, so I go in and sit down with our friend in his office. And I'm like, sir, I would like to make you a loan to get a snowboard. And he's like, okay, you know, how are you going to pay this back? Recycling, I'm collecting. I sell some daffodils in the spring, you know, $5 a gallon. And, you know, I think I'll get this $150 back in about a year. And drew up a little document for me and got my snowboard and paid it back, you know, monthly over the year. And,
wow.
So like these awesome things.
Since you were a little kid.
You got to make it happen.
Got to make
it
happen.
But it was cool because, right? You know, it's understanding it early and then being attuned to it over the years. Really. I think is what set the foundation for me. And even with all the stuff that my dad has been involved in over the years, you know, him sharing it all. It's not like, oh yeah, this is, some stuff was worthless, but some stuff was like, hey, this is something cool as an educational opportunity for the kids. And that was such a gift.
Totally. That's actually funny you said that. I'm like, I had kind of the same experience growing up with my dad. Like he was very big emphasis on financial literacy. You know, like the allowance, the chores, you know, essentially it's like you get paid your allowance for doing the chores kind of thing. Like, but dude, it makes a huge impact because once you get down the line, like there's subtle things that you don't even realize that are kind of instilled in you that other people just aren't familiar with at all. And it's kind of shocking, especially when you get to
it. No, it really is. And being able to take it all the way up where I look back at certain stuff where you're like, oh man, you wouldn't have learned this in school, even, you know, unless you were in like MBA program.
Totally.
But to be able to get that practical is huge. And one of the things that we talk about with our kids is like, how do we instill those same foundations, you know, in their education and as they grow up to teach them about it all. Cause it's hard. It takes work.
Hell yeah.
One of our kids last night, we were renting a VRBO, something for Thanksgiving. He's like, wait, what? Like $270? Like that's so much money. Like how do grownups do it?
That's a year of chores.
It's like, I've been saving money, but like, I couldn't pay for that whole week. Like, no, that's a lot to be a grown-up. Grown-upping sucks.
Dude.
I'm thinking about the parallels there of having mentorship is so key because there's plenty of book knowledge that you can get access to if you're so inclined, but you know, someone has to kind of plant the seed and that curiosity in you, and then you get exposed to it. But to have a coach, like every world-class athlete or high performer has a coach. And it's pretty crazy that most people, when they're riding an avalanche train, don't have a coach. This is the riskiest thing they're ever going to do in their life, and they don't have a coach. And when you're talking about how to manage risk, you can tap into that experienced hand and all the crazy stuff they've seen over the years that's beyond our experience envelope. And you can sponge that up and we stand on the shoulders of the people who came ahead of us. And that's pretty amazing that you had that right from an early age. And then, that resonated with you and now it's passed down to your kids.
No, it's important. I mean, and what you touch on there for the backcountry, I think is huge, right? I mean, mentorship is how so many people, how you take it from like book knowledge and theory to like truly applying it in the field and applying it properly in the field. I remember going out like the first time, you know, you're like poking fingers in snow pits and you're like, how hard do you poke? Like, until you're doing it like with somebody, it's like, yeah, you know, yeah, exactly. Right. But like, how hard is that? And you're like, okay, did my finger just go in the same depth as this dude who's really experienced? Ah, okay. That's actually right.
What's the mass of his finger compared to my finger? Like what?
All right. You just analyze all that. And you're doing some calculations in the field and you go, okay, same glove. We'll go same glove. But no, it is. I mean, it's so critical in everything in life.
I feel like there's a funny, and Will, this is Jeff. You're on the other side of this, but Will, maybe you can feel this like, or tell me how you feel. I felt like every time over the years, like when I started getting into backcountry skiing or got back into backcountry skiing, there's almost this sort of vibe of like, hey, here's the rules, but like, good luck.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really till I started hanging out with Jeff and where it was more of this conversation. It is mentorship. Like I learned so much from Jeff every time I go skiing. Like it wasn't till I had that relationship where it was more like I could just ask stupid questions that I realized like how much I didn't understand. Like I thought I understood, but I had misunderstood. Like I'd learned it wrong. And to me, that was like the most startling thing I learned through this whole like process of working with Aspidavi and doing all this stuff is like, dude, I essentially did like Avi level one way back in the day when I was like 18, and I didn't touch the backcountry for years because I had friends who died and like all that kind of stuff, and I just didn't trust myself. I didn't think I had a handle on it. And then I came back and started skiing with Jeff, and we kind of did like a refresher and all that kind of stuff. And it isn't even until now that I'm like, now I'm starting to feel like I have a grasp on it. But before, it just seemed like people are getting like thrown to the wolves. Like it's not for any sinister reason. It's almost just sort of like the way the architecture. Like, did you kind of have that experience?
Completely. I think we were lucky in general in life, right? The best way to like get better in anything is do it with people that are better than you. I mean, get out there with someone that's faster than you on a bike and follow them down a hill. You know, it applies across the board, and that's how you learn best. But also, as you just said there, you've got to be able to ask dumb questions. You know, especially in the skiing side, it's not just following them. It's like, why? Like, why did you make that decision? And you have to be able to feel a little bit uncomfortable with where you are yourself to be able to ask that. And if you can't, if you just nod, yeah, it's like, you're never going to learn it. So I think it's, totally. You know, for everybody, it's finding those people you can go out with that you're comfortable with, that are willing to push you just a little bit, or willing not to push you, but tell you why we're not pushing. And assess. It's probably one of the biggest challenges in the sport, isn't it? And I think that's one of the things that, I mean, I was talking to somebody about Aspidavi the other day, actually, and they're like, well, you just go ski, you know, find a good mentor. I was like, well, not everybody can find a good mentor.
Where do you do that?
And even then, like, we still make bad decisions. You know, people do, like, we know it. If there's something, I think one of the most powerful things that this app does is it prompts thought. It gives you yes, no's, right? But it also like, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are going to disregard that. And that's personal choices, right? It's like, it's what's personal tolerance for risk. But if you're going to disregard it, it made you think one more time, like, hey, you're making a bad choice, or you're making a very risky choice. Is it worth it? And that's, you can't have a digital mentor, but you can have a digital gut check. And that can be a digital gut check.
Well, and it's also good to like have something visualized of like going back to what we mentioned before of, you know, something's dangerous, but it's totally theoretical and it's really easy to push away. It's like, it's easy to be in denial about it, but then having a tool that's like, oh shit, this thing is literally showing us what we're doing is the base jumping. Like the red is,
oops.
You know, it's like, oh man, it's way harder to like have that cognitive disconnect, I guess. When you have this thing,
it's so easy.
You in the face.
Yeah, we're all so good at rationalizing anything and everything in life. When there is a hard line that's there for you, kind of kills your ability to like rule it out through rationalization.
Yeah, it's funny.
You're so shy.
It's even worse. I can't bully people with my knowledge and like guidance. because they're like, hey, Jeff.
Yeah, dude, you made this thing.
Yeah, this is a high risk move, and we're just not down for that. And be like, yeah, I was getting a little. Yeah, that doesn't really hold up in court, does it? I felt really good about it.
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to someone. I was telling someone about Aspidavi like a couple months ago, and they're like very experienced backcountry skier, and I was showing them. You know, I think right now we just have a random forecast on there from January of last year.
Forecast. Yep.
Something to play with. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was showing them that and they're like, oh, well, I ski that stuff all the time. And I was like, well, yeah, this is not like, I was like, oh, that's interesting. Cause we're not like telling you what you can and can't ski. We're just showing you how dangerous what you want to ski is, you know? And it's like, so we're not saying like you're a bad person if you go ski that. This is just an aid for you to be like,
no, but just think about
is this dangerous right now?
The answer is yes.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking an interesting analogy would be, like I'm a bad driver. Like I'm a rally car driver, like finish rally car driver, Mika Hakkinen, and get the Hakkapeliitta studded tires on the Suvi. And like, you know, I so bad. It would be hilarious. Instead of a speedometer, it has a riskometer. And, you know, the risk isn't linear. It goes up logarithmic curve. So it'd be hilarious instead of a speedo to have, you know, the risk-o. And it's like,
doesn't State Farm have that little black box they keep trying to put in your car? And they're like, oh, yeah, we'll give you good rates. And you're like, I don't want that thing in my car. Hell no. Like, not a chance.
They're like, we see you've been going to Taco Bell a lot this week. What's up with that? You're like...
The gorditas, man.
That would affect your life insurance rate, right? With your cardiac. Yeah.
They know everything.
That's awesome.
Hey, I got to ask him, Dave. Will, if you were an avalanche, what kind of avalanche would you be?
Ooh, I'm going to have to ask you as well. But I might go with that persistent slab thing from earlier. I mean, it's like, you know, ideally, you're not messing with people too much. You're letting them have fun. But every once in a while, you just got to lay the smack down. And I would say either that or a slough. Ideally, the slough is, it's kind of unthreatening. It's friendly, but like it makes you think just a little bit.
These are totally opposite ends of the spectrum. One is predictable and easy to manage, and the other one is wildly unpredictable.
It's impossible.
Impossible to manage. So which is it?
Keep people on their toes. Keep them on their toes.
Perfectly goes
the paradox here. Jung would love this.
This perfectly loops back into Will, like the dark side of Will. As also like the light side of Will, you know, he's like sometimes
gotta be light and fluffy and happy and just fun. Have a good time. He's
fucking instant death.
Well, the slough is what can send that persistent slab, you know, in the worst case scenario.
True. Mm.
Yeah.
Jeff, what are you, dude?
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to get the cross check on that. I wonder what my ex-wife would say, but I would say that I'm a storm slab. And when you're often working in a mechanized operation, you get a lot of laps in. Or sometimes if you've been in a ski area and there's an instability in the storm snow where it came in cold and fluffy and then it's a little bit top heavy, it's very predictable in how it's going to break and where it's going to break. And often it's like the same within a degree or two, like 37, 38 degree slope rollover where you can get it to go. But it's... you know, oftentimes it's not the biggest consequences. And it's fun to interact with, and more predictable than say an old snow problem. Having said
that, you're fun to interact with.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's my self-perception and somewhat predictable about what you're going to get. You're going to get someone quirky, odd, playful, curious is my self-perception, but yeah, it'd be interesting to throw that out to my friends. They're like, oh no, he's deep slap for sure.
Take a poll.
We should go through all of the investors, like, what avalanche problem is Jeff in your mind?
That's a good profile for the website.
There's got to be a category on LinkedIn for that, right?
Yeah
that's next year. They're bringing it on.
Dave, how would you categorize yourself or characterize? Like, what's your scared animal?
I think I'm the human factor. I'm
not an avalanche problem.
Well, hear me out.
Okay. All right.
I have a lot of confidence in my skiing ability. Yeah. And like, I know that I can ski a lot of stuff, but if I really want to be, oh, my light died. If I really want to be honest here, like that could easily get me into all sorts of problems.
Sure.
And so, yeah, I don't know. That's kind of the way I feel about that. It could get me into any type of avalanche, really.
I was hoping you'd come up with a total non sequitur and say something like, I'm a dolphin.
I'm a whale. That was the best. Oh, man. Well, do you guys, Will, we've taken up a lot of your time, man. Thanks for hopping on. This has been really fun.
Oh, Dave, I got one more. Okay. I got one more. What haven't we asked you that we should have asked you? What don't we know about you to ask? What don't we know enough to, about you to ask?
That's a good question. You'd have to ask my wife that one. She'd have a far better answer.
Well, Coral can chime in if she's in the background.
Now, what would I say? I think my earbud might have just died there.
What didn't we ask Will in the interview here in the podcast? What didn't we ask Will that we should have asked?
Oh, I'm going to say, like, what is... what's making me happiest these days? Because I think it's one of the most important things in life, is what's making you happy. What is it that you do when you're not wearing a neck brace that brings joy? And it's fun after all the years where like that was focused on cycling or was focused on work. Now it's focused on kids. And it kind of ties it back to like teaching these little dudes to be able to go out and play. It's honestly one of the coolest things being a dad, being a parent, being a mom, helping instill your love of the outdoors. Or the love of anything in your kid's psyche and help them understand how to do it well, how to do it safely, but also to have a blast. And there's nothing better than going out, skiing with your kids, seeing them doing something you love. And I think especially at the ages where ours are now, 8 and 10, that they can do that. You can go out and you ride a mountain bike with them. And you're like, we just went on a real ride. It's not like I need to go on exercise afterwards. It's like, we just did something awesome. And it's the same thing, Nordic skiing, like, both our kids are part of the Nordic program here. You can go out last spring and you're like skating up towards paradise, with your kids. You're like, this is pretty magic. I think for everybody that is one of the coolest things in life. And it's what's making me tick these days.
Yeah. It's a different type of adventure, right? It sounds like there's this theme that goes through from early on till now of adventure and risk and reward. And I like that idea of adventure. It gets really interesting when the outcome's a bit uncertain and we're not quite sure how this adventure is going to play out. And it seems like you guys do that a lot with your kids, whether it's traveling around the world or starting a new business venture or taking them out backcountry skiing. Yeah.
Oh, it's the best. It's sharing the stuff you love with the little people that are going to then share it with you for their whole lives and keep doing it even after you can't.
Do you and Coral have like sidebars after you watch your kids do stuff where you're like, holy shit, like it's kind of like they're getting like kind of sick, like, or should we be concerned?
Constantly. That's going to be important.
That's awesome. Oh man, well thank you so much for coming on. It was really fun connecting with you. I'm glad your neck is going to be okay. That's freaking crazy, man. Moral of the story here, ladders, the riskiest thing.
Don't play on them. Always ask for help. Have someone holding it or handing it up to you. And then, ideally, if you are going to get hurt like this, time it for mud season.
Great pro tip.
I got lucky.
Late April or like kind of October zone.
Yeah, but it's working pretty well right now. By the time there's good snow, I should be back at it.
Yeah, that's perfect. It'll be great.
Well, I got to put in a shameless plug. If you want to join Will and Coral and invest in Aspect Avi and help this mission come to fruition of saving lives from avalanches by making the backcountry safer and more fun for everyone, you can look us up at Aspect Avi and hit the contact us and drop us an email. And you can join us for as little as $100 on WeFunder, which is like a Kickstarter for investing.
Yeah, we'll throw a link in the show notes for WeFunder for anyone who's interested. It's very easy.
Highly recommended. Hop on board. Help make it happen.
Become a part of this team.
The magic.
Yeah, I will say that our board meetings are super fun. True. They often involve face shots, and the investor retreat is really something.
Yeah, and usually have very good views.
Very much so.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, guys, thank you so much for having me on today, and I look forward to getting out and playing some this winter when it's possible again.
Yeah, looking forward to getting back touring with you, Will.
That's it. That's the show. Thanks so much for listening, watching, however you're doing your pods these days. If you like what we're doing, please consider subscribing, leaving a review or a rating, sending it to your friends. It really does help us out. One last thanks to our business daddy, Aspect Avi, for making the All Aspects podcast possible. If you want to try out Aspect Avi for yourself, head on over to the App Store and download it on iOS for free. Thanks so much for listening, watching, and we'll see you in the next one. You.
I love it, and I'm a rally car driver, like Finnish rally car driver, Mika Hakkinen, and get the Hakkapeliitta studded tires on the CV, and like, you know, I'm so bad. And it would be hilarious, instead of a speedometer, it has a